Good morning. I'm Sue Penfield, and I have a role which I'm proud to play in this talk, and that is that I get to introduce the next speaker. This is part of a speaker series of four speakers who will be doing and presenting to you very current research that they're all doing on interdisciplinary perspectives in language documentation. So much like the plenary this morning, which was looking specifically at ethnobiology, each of these speakers brings a little different discipline into view for those of us who work in language documentation. And the first speaker, since we're running late, I'll introduce very quickly, is Niklas Bernhardt from Sweden, who happens to work, I think, in lots of places, but I'm particularly interested in having him share his work in Malaysia with you. And he works most broadly with language documentation and landscape. So this is a chance to look at disciplines of geography coming together with language documentation in, I think, some interesting ways. So with that, I'll give you Niklas.
Thank you very much. And special thanks to Susan and to the National Science Foundation for the invitation. It's great to be here. So when we pursue our documentation programs, our mandate is typically to record as many types of communicative events as possible. Now, this is tricky, especially with a time frame of 2 or 3 years, which would be the case for most language documentation projects. And of course, the trick is to try to focus in some way in order to make our documentation agenda more efficient and ideally also more theoretically interesting. And there are many ways of doing that, and we will hear about many of them at this conference, I think. One way of doing it is to go for a particular semantic domain. And for example, we heard Nick Evans talk earlier this morning about ethnobiology as one such domain, which is, in my view, also a very fruitful domain in order to in conducting language documentation. And I would like to discuss or bring up another interesting domain, and that's the domain of landscape. So in my talk today, I will first of all present some of the reasons why I think landscape is of interest to the humanities in general and also to linguistics in particular. And towards the end of my talk, I will try to connect the two areas of landscape and language documentation. How does this... Yeah, there we go. It's actually difficult to imagine another domain with such clear connections to a range of really fundamental aspects of the human experience as landscape. From concrete things like dwelling, subsistence, navigation, and motion, which are clearly anchored in landscape, to far less concrete things like memory, time, identity, emotion, and spirituality, which arguably also have very clear connections to landscape. So one of the things that is particularly interesting about landscape is that all humans, all speech communities, will inhabit a landscape. We can't step out of it. And this means that language and cognition needs to pay universal attention to the domain. At the same time, as we all know, landscapes vary radically, and that means that language and cognition also need to have a certain degree of plasticity and flexibility in terms of how the domain is categorized. I'd like to list a couple of reasons why I think landscape is interesting from a linguistic point of view. And I will begin with the whole issue of conceptualization. So landscape may be a very fundamental domain, but it's actually a really tricky domain for language and cognition. And that's because landscape does not, for the most part, come pre-segmented by nature, unlike ethnobiology in some way. And I would just like to give you a couple of examples here of the type of diversity that we can see in how languages carve up landscape and landscape features. So first of all, this will be like a comparison between three different languages. So Jahai, which is an Austroasiatic language in the Malay Peninsula, Lao, a Thai Kadai language in mainland Southeast Asia, and Yelidnir, a Papuan language in Melanesia. And we will have a look at how these three languages, with their monolexemic terms, categorize a river system. So let's First of all, make clear that these are monolexemic ways of labeling rivers. If we include compounds, for example, we will see a very different picture and a different type of diversity. So let's stick to monolexemic labels. And as we can see, Jahai has one label to refer to a river system, and it's basically the term for water. Whereas Lao and Ye Lijie have a more fine-grained distinction in their segmentation of rivers, but according to very different principles, as you can see here. I won't go into detail because we're short of time. Okay, another reason why I think a landscape is interesting is because it hosts one of the two major categories of proper names that there are, and that's, of course, toponyms, place names. Now, there's a long history of research on toponyms, specifically, you know, etymology, the history and meaning of place names, but actually there's been very little research done on the referential properties of place names, and even less on the relationship between the referential properties of place names and the referential properties of generic terms, the landscape terms. And if we compare these three languages again, we see, again, a type of diversity. And let's start by looking at Lao and Ye Lijie, which actually follow the same principle in how they apply proper names to landscape features. And that is, they pick out the same features as those which are labeled by generic terms and give them, they individuate them by giving them proper names. So even though they segment a river in different ways, they apply the same principle of picking out generic features for individuation and naming. Jahai does something completely different. Jahai names areas rather than features. And these areas usually correspond to drainage areas of water features, but there's no term for drainage area in Jahai, and this means that there's a mismatch between the proper naming system and the system of labeling with generic terms. Ontologically, quite a different way of doing it from what these guys are doing. A third reason why I think landscape is interesting from a linguistic point of view is a type of semantic systems or lexical configurations which seem to be particularly prone to, or landscape seems particularly prone to host these semantic systems, and these configurations are all about harmonizing semantics across form classes. And this is a concept that Steve Levinson and I have recently labeled semplates, and I have an example here from Jahai. Again, this is the language that I'm primarily working on in Malaysia, an Austroasiatic language. And in Jahai, there's a sagittal lateral template which structures lexicon in relation to rivers and lexicon from very different form classes. So if we begin, for example, with body part terms, which are mapped metaphorically onto rivers, it looks like this. A very systematic, spatially very coherent template, metaphorical template, with a head of water being at the top end of a drainage system, the bottom or buttocks of water at the mouth, ironically, of a river system. shoulders of river are upper tributaries. The river has a right, the river has a left. The surface of a river is its back. The bottom of a river is its chest. So it's a really coherent body which structures water in this way. Head up, face down. A second class of nouns which map metaphorically onto the same features are kinship terms. So we have a term mother, which applies to the main sagittal dimension of running water, and then tributaries, the lateral dimension here, is represented by her children. The same distinction pops up in motion verbs, with one verb which means to move along a mother water, and then distinct verbs for to move up or down along a child water like this. This parallels to some extent the hopping verbs that Nick Evans mentioned this morning. We see the same distinction in positional verbs with a verb which denotes location along a mother water versus one which denotes location along a child water. And indeed, the whole system of place naming maps onto the same distinctions, the same sagittal lateral distinction, where where you have large-scale names which associate with the drainage systems of the mother, and smaller-scale names which associate with the drainage systems of her lateral children. Now, the fact that these different form classes map onto the same template is actually unaccounted for by semantic theory, which is why we developed this concept of templates, which seem to be particularly apparent in landscape. It's not restricted to landscape, this phenomenon, but most of our examples are from the landscape domain. So a good reason to look at landscape from the lexical point of view. Okay, so those were some of the reasons why I think landscape is interesting. There are more, but in the interest of time, I will move on to sort of the next step of my talk, and that's trying to discuss landscape in relation to language documentation. So if we return to our task as language documenters, which is basically to collect as many types of communicative events as we can on a scale of spontaneity, from exclamations and conversations at one end of the scale to highly structured interviews and elicitation sessions, or indeed indigenously structured types of events like myth, ritual, poetry, and song at the other end of the scale. If we want to look for a domain where all of these things are relevant, landscape is a good place to start. I mean, you can exclaim about landscape, you can converse about landscape. There will be stories, definitely myths, creation myths about landscape in most of our speech communities. Arguably, there will be rituals involved, poetry, song. And of course, we can structure our interviews and our elicitation sessions so that they target landscape and questions relating to landscape. I'd like to echo Nick's hailing of lexicon as an important thing to look at. And in relation to landscape, we have some serious lexical classes here which are interesting. The main ones, of course, being landscape terms and place names, which anchor very, very firmly, of course, into the domain. Arguably, they are universal categories, and there are not many such things. You could argue that all languages probably will have landscape terms and place names. We don't know for sure, but that's a good guess. But there are other lexical classes and grammatical categories which are interesting, potentially, depending on your language, of course, but potentially interesting in most settings. And for example, motion terms. Motion verbs will be relevant in landscape. There are languages which have specific motion verbs which encode motion in relation to specific landscape features. Jahai was one example I showed you earlier. I'll get back to it in just a moment. Things like idiophones and expressives, how do they behave in relation to landscape? How does human perception and the linguistic expression of that pan out in relation to landscape here? The phenomenon of a metaphor, as we saw, is interesting in landscape. Is it the case that landscape is always the target domain of metaphor, with, for example, body part terms and kinship terms mapping onto landscape? Or could it be the other way around, that landscape is the source domain whose terms is mapped onto other domains? And we do have some examples of that too. And then close grammatical classes like demonstratives and directionals, which at least in some speech communities have a very, very, very clear connection to landscape, encoding things like elevation and the flow of running water. So I guess my point is that if you're looking for a domain where all of these things become relevant and where we can sort of fulfill our documentational obligations, landscape is actually a good domain, I think. But one thing that makes landscape even more interesting from a documentation point of view is that it's not only possible to document the linguistic categories, the lexicon, the grammar, and the use of language. It's also possible to document what is talked about. And here I'm alluding to GIS, geographical information systems, and our the possibility to actually record in X, Y, and Z coordinates what is talked about. And I would like to bring up three different ways of thinking about using GIS in documentation. Now, I was having dinner with David Mark. Where's David? There you are. I was having dinner with David Mark yesterday, and we talked about the definition of GIS, And I think my definition of GIS is probably a bit more generous and liberal than David's. So basically what I will be talking about here is computer mapping of things and how you can map your indigenous categories in a computerized way, in a digitized way. But of course, that mapping can then secondarily be used for various GIS purposes, being used for various applications and so on. But I will talk about the simple aspects today of how to use GIS or geocoding in relation to language documentation. And the first type is what I would like to call GIS documentation at meta level. And that's basically including GPS or geocoding in your metadata. So for example, you can add geotagging to your word lists and connect it to other types of metadata. Every recording that you make can be anchored in space by means of geotagging and so on, which helps you to keep track of your documentation in the spatial sense. In a way, you know, your footprints, your documentational footprints will be recorded in space this way. This does not necessarily have a clear relationship with landscape, but at least there's spatial information in here which you and ideally future generations of researchers can use to reconstruct what you've been doing in relation to space. The second type of GIS documentation or way of thinking about GIS documentation is what I would call post-narrative documentation. Basically what I mean is that you have a collection of recordings, for example, or a lexicon. It could be legacy materials, it could be new recordings, and you pick out the spatially relevant things, the landscapey relevant things in your materials, and you create an indigenous map from that. So say you pick out demonstratives which encode landscape features, or place names or terms for generic features in landscape, and you try to locate these on a map and give them the right coordinates, and you reconstruct space on the basis of your existing materials. This is what many of us are doing, and it's quite a good way of hooking language to landscape. It's quite a difficult way. It depends a bit on the genre. So if you have travel narratives, for example, it will be easier than if you have a general narrative about something and the place name pops up here and there, and it could be difficult to actually find the place of that particular name. You might need to go out there with your GPS device and get the point, or indeed sit with your consultants, with a map and get them to point things out. But the basic principle is to create a map from your recordings. But then there's another way of doing it, which I've experimented a little bit with myself, and that's what I would like to call pre-narrative GIS documentation. and in this case, it's all about getting the indigenous landscape first. Try to collect as many categories in the form of, for example, features, generic features which have labels. Try to get consultants on site during field walking, for example, to define them for you. You record them in your GPS. Place names, same thing. This is a screenshot from my own Jahai field setting with a few of the categories that are relevant there. There will be different categories, of course, in different field settings, and there will be different ways of recording these things. I've recorded place names with points, for example. In other contexts, it might be more convenient to record them as polygons, and of course, we're restricted to those categories, points, lines, and polygons in GIS, which is a bit problematic, but it's what we got. And then, in the Jahai case at least, we have different motion verbs. So there's one verb which means to move along a major waterway. There's another verb for to move along a mountainside. A third verb to move along the crest of a ridge, for example. These are really, really easy to record as tracks in your GPS. You know the relationship between the semantics and the motion and your recording of it is really straightforward in this case, unlike in some of the other examples. Okay, so you create your indigenous representation of landscape in landscape first. This needs probably a bit of knowledge from before. You need to have your lexicon. You need to know some of the principles in order to do this. But the idea is to do this recording first, and then you make your language recording. So, for example, if you ask one of the consultants who joined you on this field walk where you recorded all these things and get that person to explain to another native speaker who did not join on that trip, you will get conversation, you will get a narrative about this particular landscape. Or if, for example, you have a number of people who joined you on the trip, you get them together and get them to talk about that trip. So you get a conversation about, not a description, but a conversation about what happened. And that means that you will have a very, very clear connection between the categories you've recorded and the actual, recorded language use. So like a condensed way of doing what I showed you in the previous slide, and arguably a more efficient way. It will be more focused, more restricted. But if we're looking to find ways of dealing with specific issues in relation to language and landscape, this is probably a more efficient way of doing it. I will have two very, very general and probably obvious conclusions. One is that I think landscape is linguistically really interesting and worthy of targeted documentation. And the second one is that landscape offers unusual opportunities to record not only language use, but also the ecology of language and its use. And I would like to make a connection to video recording here. So we're encouraged by our funding agencies to use video rather than audio for good reasons. You can see who is talking. Ideally, you can see who that person is talking to, or even more ideally, you can see what that person is talking about in the video recording. And of course, video picks up things that are not picked up by audio, like gesture and gaze. And one could think of GIS or computerized mapping of indigenous categories as the next step. It's a way of extending your documentation of what is talked about beyond video. So it's not a totally or entirely different ball game. It's extending the documentation agenda in a way. Thank you.
This is a question in time. Are there any questions for the speaker? Are there any questions? You can see the audience better than I
do. Here's one.
You mentioned at the very end the significance of gesture. I think actually around the communicative events that signify movement in the landscape, gesture is a really important one, both in terms of the gestures that accompany a spontaneous narrative, but we also have, I'm speaking for the Squamish language in the interior of BC, but I think this exists throughout indigenous territories, we have systems of sign language that actually as gestured communication about movement in landscape, but then often also through visible signs that are left in the landscape of people's movements or indicating where somebody has gone, that I think are a really important part of the whole way in which this kind of fits together.
Sure. So one of the reasons that I made this particular, so the screenshot that I showed you and the motion verbs, one of the reasons was that I actually wanted to start to look at the gestures and how they were, the morphology of gestures in relation to different types of motion and so on. I haven't done that work yet, but it's definitely, integrating the indigenous representation of landscape with video here is, the connection is apparent. I should mention that it's a very exhausting type of elicitation, first of all, especially the up and down thing. I use GTAC. Can't remember now the exact number and stuff, but it's a GTAC handheld GPS computer with ArcPad. That's the software. and there you can upload various, you know, layers. You can get, depending on where you work, you can get different types of maps and satellite pictures, so you see where you are. And it's pretty straightforward. I'm not the expert on the actual tech side here, but it's pretty straightforward.
Excuse me. You talk about the Jahai and their lack of terminology for parts of the river.
Yes. Well,
is this in any way connected to possible roaming way style of life?
Oh, in relation, yeah. I'd be wary of making very clear connections to like subsistence mode and so on. I don't see such a connection.
Because if you look at the Austronesians right next door or in the same area,
right,
they do completely different things.
Yeah.
Very elaborate terminology for looking for the parts of the river.
Yeah. Well, what I could say that, so there are several forager groups associated, different ethno-linguistic groups, all doing foraging as their main type of subsistence. And you have, actually, even if the languages are closely related, they live next door to each other, they lead very similar lifestyles, but they have extremely different ways of categorizing the landscape. The reason for that, I don't know whether there are slight differences in what the landscape actually looks like. I don't know, but so I wouldn't make a prediction like, you know, associating foraging, for example, with a particular way of categorizing things.
A comment rather than a question. You showed a very nice example of using landscape or landscape mapping as an interface, if you like, for linguistic data, and Nick's plenary talked about interdisciplinarity and the importance of that, and it made me think of a project that I had been briefly involved with long ago, but I think it still exists, called the Electronic Cultural Atlas Initiative, which uses maps as an interface for interdisciplinary interaction, if you like,
right,
which would build on the sort of thing that you've shown, where people coming from different angles could access not only linguistic data, but if people were then working collaboratively, geological, historical, or biological as well. So that people are, I think, working on taking the mapping of the landscape, I think, to that interdisciplinary level as well.
So I think, if we look at landscape specifically and you know, the way we can use GIS from in the linguistic way, so geography is probably the discipline with most interest in this. And of course, David Mark here represents that discipline and also its new sub-branch, ethnophysiography, which deals exactly with variation here, and I think this is a good way to meet geography. Of course, it's an obvious connection, but I'm sure there will be other disciplines interested in a similar type of spatial representation of language, perhaps ethnobiology too. A bit difficult with moving targets like animals, but certainly in relation to trees and species and stands of vegetation.
Time just for one more question, Andrea.
I was wondering, I was interested in your work where you showed an Elan transcript of lots of conversation and then going through and sort of mining the conversation for reference to locations, either by toponym or just by demonstratives, et cetera. Are you actually linking that information into the, are you making part of the annotation as well? Are you somehow adding Lat-Lange data to the Elan file?
So, yeah, okay, so I haven't done that type of GIS work, only the last thing where you actually do the mapping first and the recording.
Physically mapping first.
Yeah. No, I don't think there's a way of doing it in Elan. I wish there was. It's again making the connection to video. It's you know, it's another layer of representation in a way, which ideally should be in there. I don't know if it's technically possible, but I think we have the Elan developers. Maybe not in the audience, but definitely at the conference. So,
yeah.
So it's really easy to archive digitally GIS data, because it's just figures basically, and you can upload them as a.
Yeah, actually, that's what we're in the process of doing. But since the text file, since the tier files are text files,
yeah, you can just put it in there.
It becomes very easy.
Is that what you were doing?
Yes.
So space is not temporal in itself, which makes it a bit different from video, for example. But surely you can hook things to sort of the temporal things in the actual narrative, for example.
Our time is up. If anybody has any questions, I think Nick's going to be around for the whole conference, right?
And then tomorrow we'll have another talk on yet another discipline, so tune in again.
Thank you.